This is the 2010 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our theme for the weekend is the prophecy of Ezekiel 38 with our brother Roger Lewis. This is session number 6, entitled Gog, the Latter-day Scythian. Brother Roger.
Well, tonight's session is actually one of two that we're going to do on the matter of Gog himself. We obviously looked very briefly at a profile of Gog just before our evening meal, but in this session tonight, as our chairman has announced, we're going to look at Gog as being the latter-day Scythian, and we're going to use this study to help identify the historical basis for Ezekiel 38. Because one of the things that we do know for certain is that none of the prophets prophesied in a vacuum. There was always an historical setting to the prophet's own day and the prophet's own time and the prophet's own circumstance when a prophecy came forth. Irrespective, by the way, of whether we think that prophecy's been fulfilled or not, when Ezekiel prophesied it, it would have presumably meant something to the people of Ezekiel's day. And what I'm going to suggest in this session is, yes, I think it very much would have meant something to them, and we're going to investigate why. Now, for purposes of our study tonight, our investigation begins in the book of Numbers and in the words of Balaam. The book of Numbers and chapter 24. And in Numbers 24... the record tells us these words in verse 28. Numbers 24, sorry, not verse 28, verse 20. When he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and he said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he shall perish forever. So a couple of interesting things then about this observation concerning Amalek. First of all, does anyone know what the name of the king of the Amalekites was? Agag, king of the Amalekites. Takes us back to the days of Samuel, doesn't it? And this is not the purpose of our study tonight, but you know, there's a very interesting analogy. In the book of Samuel, do you remember it says that Samuel took a sword and hewed Agag in pieces before Yahweh? And that action of Samuel becomes typical of the sacrifice of Gog on the mountains of Israel in Ezekiel 39. The sacrificial offering of Agag, the king of the Amalekites, becomes a prototype of the sacrifice of the Gogian host on the mountains of Israel in the prophecy of Ezekiel in chapter 39. But I just wanted to draw your attention to a couple of things in the prophecy here in Numbers 24. Firstly, it says in verse 20, when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he shall perish forever. Now, what do you think it means when it says Amalek was the first of the nations? Because Amalek wasn't the first of the nations in terms of order of sequence. He wasn't the first of the nations in terms of order of size, in terms of order of importance. But the margin says, he was the first of the nations that warred against Israel. I'm not sure whether that's what you're going to say, Ben, but of course the Amalekites became famous, didn't they? As Israel journeyed towards the land, the Amalekites would come and pick off the stragglers at the end, wouldn't they? Those that were not following in the way. And they exhibited hostility towards the children of Israel. So they become an early prototype of those who are hostile to Israel and its cause. Now, concerning the king both of Israel and the king of these Amalekites, whose latter end is that he shall perish forever, the record says this further back in Numbers 24 and verse 5. Balaam said, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. He sees the future glory and destiny of the nation. As the valleys are they spread forth as gardens by the river's side, as the trees of lime aloes which Yahweh hath planted, and as cedar trees beside the waters. He shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Now, let me tell you something interesting about that. Who was the king who came against Agag? Not the prophet, but the king. And the answer is Saul. Now, Saul was the first king of Israel. And it's Saul, the first king of Israel, that comes against Agag, the king of the Amalekites. But I think that when Numbers 24 says his king, the king of Israel, his king shall be higher than Agag, and his king shall be over a kingdom that shall be exalted, I don't think that the prophecy of Balaam has got anything to do with the first king of Israel. I think it's a prophecy of the last king of Israel, isn't it? The last king who in fact is Messiah. Now have a look at this, because there's something interesting about this, because what I think we've got hidden in this prophecy of Balaam, well, let me show you. So Numbers 24, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, he shall pour water out of his bucket, his seed, the seed of this king to come, his king shall be higher than Agag. Ah, but the Septuagint says, no, higher than Gog. And the Septuagint translates the word Agag with the word Gog. His seed shall be higher than Gog, and his kingdom shall be exalted. And notice that this is around about the year BC 1410. So all the way back in the prophecy of Balaam, at least as far as the Septuagint version is concerned, we've got a reference to Gog. Not sure what the basis of the Septuagint translation is, but clearly that was a name that the Septuagint translators were familiar with. And the way they translated the Hebrew was with, in fact, that Greek word, the Greek form of the word Gog. And when you stop and think about it, that makes good sense, doesn't it? Because if Agag is the king over whom the first king of Israel is exalted, well, actually it's Gog who really is the king over whom the last king of Israel shall be exalted when his kingdom spreads abroad and his seed is in many waters. So right back in the days of Balaam, we've got the first hint of something that may have a Gogian overtone based on the Agag of old who was hostile to the ways of Israel and whom Samuel slew as a prototype of a judgment yet to come. Well, that brings us to the prophecy of Amos and chapter 7. Because in Amos chapter 7, again, we've got a rather interesting passage. And I'm going to quote again from the Septuagint translation. And in Amos 7, by the way, you all know what the Septuagint is. It's the Greek translation of the Old Testament from the Hebrew to the Greek, composed around about BC 250, so in circulation long before the time of Christ, and frequently quoted, incidentally, in the New Testament record. When you compare the Hebrew text and the Greek text, the Septuagint, and then the Greek Gospel, you'll find that many of the passages in the Greek New Testament are much more accurately aligned with the Greek of the Septuagint rather than the Hebrew of the Hebrew of the Old Testament. So it certainly not only circulated, but was extensively used, even, we believe, in the times of the apostles. Now, in Amos chapter 7 and verse 1, the record says, "Thus hath the Lord God showed unto me. And behold, he formed grasshoppers in the beginning of the shooting up of the latter growth, and lo, it was the latter growth after the king's mowings. It came to pass that when they'd made an end of eating the grass of the land, I said, O Lord God, forgive, I beseech thee, by whom shall Jacob arise? For he is small. And Yahweh repented for this, it shall not be, saith Yahweh." Now, that's the translation of the authorized version, but have a look at the Septuagint version, which renders this verse in a slightly different way. Amos 7 verse 1, "Thus hath Yahweh Elohim showed me, behold a swarm of locusts coming from the east." And then the Septuagint says, "And behold one caterpillar, King Gog. And it came to pass when he had finished devouring the grass of the land that I said, Lord God, be merciful, who shall raise up Jacob?" Now isn't that unusual? Hidden in the Septuagint version, one caterpillar, King Gog, it says. Now, again, we've got no background to why the Septuagint translation renders this phrase in this particular way. But let me tell you what's strange about this. Well, I can't actually put it up on the board, I was going to, but it just so happens, do you notice that this prophecy was composed, written rather, BC 750, and it just so happens that probably around about that very date, a real man was born whose real name was Gog. At the very time that Amos gave a prophecy that says, behold, one caterpillar, King Gog, a man was born of that very name. Almost on the spot at the time of Amos's prophecy. Now, the locusts, incidentally, that were going to invade, or the grasshoppers of this chapter, the ones that were ready to invade Israel at that time were, in fact, the Assyrians. That was the actual historical context of Amos's prophecy. But even at that moment, there was a caterpillar in existence who would be an earnest, a prototype of the last great oppressor of Israel that would come down to consume both the people and the land. And a man was born whose surname or whose name was Gog. Which really brings us to the cylinder of Ashurbanipal. Now, Ashurbanipal was one of the great Assyrian kings. One of the last Assyrian kings. In fact, from the time of Ashurbanipal, the Assyrian kingdom began to decline. In fact, I might just do that thing. Just let me just stop that for a moment. Do we have a picture of that screen? Is it safe for me to erase that particular? I think, Len, you took a copy of that, didn't you? So let me just take this, make this clean for a minute, because I just wanted to put a couple of dates up here that might be relevant. So Ashurbanipal was one of the great Assyrian kings. He was not only famous, but he was ferocious. He was extraordinarily successful, but from the time of his death, the might and power of the Assyrian kingdom began to decline. And as with so many of the Assyrian kings, he was rather fond of recording his exploits, particularly his victories, and doing so in the form of clay prisms or clay cylinders. And there is a cylinder which has been discovered, which is known as the cylinder of Ashurbanipal. And on that cylinder, there is some interesting detail. And I'm just going to show you that detail in a minute, but I'm just going to put this, just so that we don't lose this before we move off from Amos, is BC 750. So I'll come back to that in a minute. So the cylinder of Ashurbanipal says this. And this is about BC 660. So this is a few years later. So how much later is that after Amos chapter 7? What's BC 750 down to BC? It's about 90 years later, okay? So the cylinder of Ashurbanipal, that means, by the way, that if there was a man called Gog, how old was he then? He was obviously about 90 years old. So do you think he was leading the army at that stage? Probably not. Who's most likely to be leading the army that Gog was leading by that stage? No, probably not his grandsons, but certainly his sons would be in the prime of their life, wouldn't they? If you took 40 as a typical sort of time period, if that's the year of the birth of Gog, and we said let's roll on 40 years, we've got the birth of the sons, and we roll on another 40 years, what do we come to? What's that? 680. We've got some wonderful mathematicians here. 40 years off 710. Do I hear 670 from the Audit Department of Washington? Excellent. Okay. Okay. So this would be the sort of suggested timetable is if Gog was born about BC 750, then we'd expect his sons to turn up to be born about BC 710. So how old would they be in BC 660? They'll be in the prime of their life, won't they? So I think they would be highly likely to be the leaders in battle at that time. This is what the cylinder of Ashurbanipal says. The cuneiform inscription of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, who lived from BC 669 to 633, mentions side by side with Biragutri, who was the chief of the Madai or the Medes, he mentions the names Sariti and Peritza, the sons of Gagi or Gog, who was the chief of the Saka or the Scythians. So that's around about spot on, isn't it? It's around about the time we'd expect these two sons to be in charge, about 50 years after they're born. Sure enough, we've got a cylinder that records these two sons as being in charge of the Scythians, and their dad's name was Gog. In fact, there are a number of scholars that believe that Gog was a title for the leader of the Scythians that was passed down through the generations as an hereditary title, just like the Caesar of Rome and the Pharaoh of Egypt and the Tsar of Russia. So the Gog was the incumbent leader of the Scythians, and that this man passed the title on. Yes. It's simply to do with the translation of the words from different languages. And I'll come to that tomorrow when you come to the word Rosh. You could have Rosh, Rus, Ras, Rasi, Rashi, Russo, Rosai. They're all simply different, you know, linguistic variants on the same common word, but as it's turned up in different languages. And we have that even today. You've got a word that in English and German and French all sound slightly the same, but in fact, they've got slightly different touches to them.
So Gog is Greek, and Gog is...
No, this is a Egyptian. This is an Assyrian cuneiform inscription.
The Gog is Assyrian?
Yep, this is all Assyrian. Yep.
Gog is a Greek word from the...
Gog is presumably, ultimately, a Scythian word.
Okay.
Because it's the name of the leader of the Scythians.
But
this is an Assyrian cylinder translating the exploits of an Assyrian king, but he mentions these two who are the sons of Gargi, which is the Assyrian term for Gog, which is in fact an Assyrian title. Does that make sense? So, in fact, just another extract that helps with that, that says, it was not one of the least surprises that we owe to Assyriology to find that Gog, king of Magog, was originally a real and historical person, no other, in fact, than the chief of the Scythians in Ashurbanipal's time, probably a warrior sufficiently renowned to have survived as a byword of terror in the memory of later generations. So whoever Gog was, he was probably a pretty ferocious warrior. He was the granddaddy of them all. And by the way, you know how cruel the Assyrians were? The Assyrians were famous, weren't they, for impaling people on spikes, putting hooks in their jaws and carting them off, doing all sorts of pretty awful stuff. Well, guess what? The Assyrians were absolutely terrified of the Scythians. If you thought the Assyrians were tough, the Scythians were monstrous. These chaps, when they came down, rather liked to have skulls from their victims, which they would lop the top off, scoop everything out, and then use that as their drinking vessel. So even the Assyrians were spooked by the ferocity of the Scythians when they came. So this is an historical reference. So the point that I'm making about all this is that Gog was an historical person. He was the leader of the Scythians. Now, that's interesting because in fact, not only is that true, but if we come down through time, there just happens to be, well, there was an invasion of the Middle East by the Scythians. And it occurred in the year BC 630. So BC 630 happens to be the ninth year of the reign of King Josiah. It was in the ninth year of Josiah's reign. It's not referred to in the Bible record, but it is historically attested to and well documented that there was an invasion of the Middle East by the Scythians at that time. Now, I just wanted to mention something about the Caucasus Mountains, because the Scythians came over these mountains. I don't know if you know much about the Caucasus Mountains. I've just got a little sort of, you know, a little brown piece there that delineates the Caucasus Mountains that basically block off the land between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Now, those mountains are very large and almost impenetrable. There are only about three or four mountain passes that allow you to get through those mountains and out to the south lands that lie below. And the Scythians lived to the north of those mountains, and everyone was very thankful that they did, because they didn't really want to see them. But in the year BC 630, they came south. Now, just let's do our numbers again. If they came south in BC 630, how old would this person, the grandson of Gog, be in 630? He'd be 40 years old. So what's interesting is that we know that this invasion of the Middle East by the Scythians in BC 630 was led by none other than Gog's grandson. Now, another interesting thing about the Caucasus Mountains. Some of you will know this, some of you won't, but, well, let me tell you what happened. What happened was the Scythians burst beyond the Caucasus Mountains. You know what Caucasus means? It means Gog's fortress. Isn't that an interesting title? That's the meaning of the word Caucasus. Gog's fortress. You see, those mountains were like a rampart barrier that was the fortress barrier that sealed off the kingdom of the Scythians to the south. But on this occasion, in the year BC 630, a man called Magdes, who's the grandson of Gog, the leader of the Scythians, came across Gog's fortress through those mountains and headed south. And they came into the Middle East. In fact, they swept south right through Palestine and came down into the land of Egypt. When they got to the land of Egypt, the pharaoh of the day, whose name was Psammeticus I, suggested that it would be a good idea to turn around and go the other way. But he had to give them a fairly substantial bribe to convince them to do that, and so he did. He paid them a vast sum of silver and gold in order to turn the Scythian confederacy back the other way, so now they came back up through the land. Now stop me if you've heard all this story before. An invasion from the north, coming over the Caucasus Mountains, sweeping down through Palestine, advancing into Egypt. Ben?
Just a question. You know, like on tests and stuff, you have to write your ethnicity, Caucasian.
Yes.
Is that where that comes from?
That's where the word comes from, I would guess, yep.
So,
yep.
We're descended from Gog.
Nice thought, isn't it? Japhethite, you're of Japhethite origin, you see. So somewhere in the background. Neil? Well, it was both, actually. What I'm suggesting is that Gog was the real person, the leader of the Scythians, but the Assyriologists, the studies that I've seen on the Scythians suggest that although the name of the leader of Gog, of the Scythians, was Gog, is that he possibly passed that title on to his successors as well. So although the grandson's name was Magdes, he was, for all purposes, the Gog of the time, because it was an hereditary title. It started as the name of the leader, but was passed on as a title. So what happened is they came down, and the king of Egypt bought them off. Now, you see down here a little black spot just there? See that little dot there? It's a little dot on the map of Israel. Well, when they came back the other way, they plundered the temple in Ashkelon. They looted the treasures of the temple in Ashkelon. And Beth Shan, which is that little city there, was renamed Scythopolis, which means the city of the Scythians. And that renaming of Beth Shan, famous in the Old Testament in the days of Saul, whose body was hung, remember, in Beth Shan. In every New Testament map, you won't find the word Beth Shan on the map. You'll only find the word Scythopolis. It's the renaming of that city. The Jewish city of Beth Shan was renamed Scythopolis, and that was actually the mark or the evidence that the Scythians had come down and come through this very area. It's like a sort of, you know, a little mark left in the land that the Scythians had been here. Yes.
Did they come on their own, or were they in concert with the Assyrians this time?
They came on their own. Well, just one last part of that story is not only did they do that, but on their way back they swept east and they went into the territory of the Medes. And they dominated the area of Iran for a period of about 10 years. So this invasion came right out of the blue. No one understood it. No one expected. All of a sudden, the Scythians burst over the mountains, came sweeping down right through this whole area, and for about 30 years, they absolutely terrorized the Middle East and held not only Palestine, but also the Medes under their control. We won't turn this up, but you might be interested in this reference. Remember I said that they were pretty ferocious chaps? There's only one reference in the New Testament which mentions the word Scythian. Ring a bell with anybody? I'll just give you the reference and you can make a note of it. Colossians chapter 3 verse 11 says, "There's neither Jew nor Greek nor Jew, circumcision nor uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free." And on this occasion, I don't think he's using barbarian and Scythian as opposites. I think he's using them as equivalents. Barbarians and Scythians. Even they could come to the truth. In other words, you wouldn't get a more remote possibility of someone coming to the truth. But in fact, they have the same opportunity to do so were they to be renewed after the image of him that created him. So, barbarians and Scythians, Colossians chapter 3. Is an interesting reference. Now, why that's all interesting is that when you come to the prophecy of Ezekiel, and now what chapter is it? I believe it's chapter 38 of the prophecy of Ezekiel, has this to say at the start of the prophecy. So Ezekiel 38 says, verse 1, "Son of man," verse 2 rather, "set thy face against Gog of the land of the Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." So let's put that down because I think this is how it should be translated. "Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of the Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him and say, thus saith the Lord God, I'm against thee, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." Now the interesting thing about that when you stop and think about that is you'll remember that it is Josephus that says that Magog founded those that from him were named Magogites, but who are by the Greeks called, why, surprise, surprise, Scythians. Gog is of the land of the Magog. Gog was the leader of the Scythians. So Gog of the Magogites is Gog, the leader of the Scythians. That's exactly what Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 2 is saying. Now here's the interesting thing in terms of dates. When did this invasion take place in the Middle East? BC 630. Do you notice from that chart when Ezekiel is given? About BC 585. So how long after the invasion of the Scythians was the prophecy of Ezekiel given? And the answer is only 45 years later. So when Ezekiel gave his prophecy about Gog of the land of the Magog coming down into the Middle East, all of the older members of Israel would easily remember the terrifying invasion only 45 years earlier by the Scythians, who, by the way, had been in the region for about 30 years. So in fact, it was only about 10 or 15 years before that the Scythians had disappeared. Oh yes, Ezekiel's own contemporaries would have known exactly what Ezekiel was talking about when he talked about Gog of the land of the Magog. So I'm not talking about the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, but Gog of the land of the Magog. They would have known exactly what Ezekiel meant. As far as they were concerned, that would have meant a promise that the Scythians are coming again. That's exactly what they would have seen it to be, considered it to mean. The Scythians are coming again. Now, let me just finish that slide off. Rosh is the most ancient form under which history makes mention of Russia. The Rus were a Scythian nation, bordering on the Taurus, answering initially to the Ukraine and northwards beyond to the steppes. So the Rus, which is going to become the burden of our study tomorrow morning, was in fact a Scythian nation themselves, one of the subsets of the great Scythian tribes. So actually, although you didn't realise it, perhaps, Ezekiel 38 had a complete historical background just a few years before. A dramatic invasion of the Middle East by the Scythians, by a man with a code name of Gog, passed down from his family, who brutalized this whole area and swept right through Palestine. And the mark of Scythopolis is the proof that that invasion took place. Now, let me tell you the really interesting thing about that story. So you see, what happens is the Scythians came down. They came into the land of Israel. They invaded that area. They terrorized the neighborhood. And then all of a sudden, as quick as they came, they went straight back up over the top of the Caucasus and disappeared. And they were never seen again. So when Ezekiel said, they're coming, Ezekiel chapter 38, Gog is going to come into the land. You can imagine all of those in Ezekiel's time were waiting in fear and trepidation of the reemergence of the Scythians over those mountains. But they never came. Never, ever again did the Scythians ever appear in the Middle East. So the strange thing about Ezekiel 38 is that although it had an immediate historical basis in the Scythian invasion in the ninth year of Josiah, just a few years before, in fact, from a prophetical point of view, Ezekiel's words never came to pass. They never came back. But when they do come back, well, you see what verse 8 says? After many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. Thou shalt come into the land. Latter years. Verse 16, thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days. So in fact, when you think about it, Ezekiel was quite specific, wasn't he? In both verse 8 and verse 16, he said, no, this is not for now. If anyone had read Ezekiel carefully, they would have noted that on two occasions, he said, this will be a latter day invasion of the Scythians. Not yet, not now. Even though the inhabitants of the nation must have waited in mortal dread of what they thought was an impending invasion that Ezekiel had prophesied of, his words, in fact, ruled it out. It wasn't for their time. It was for later. It's a future prophecy yet unfulfilled. Now, the interesting thing is that when the Scythians came, the Scythians were famous for a particular type of warfare. You'd never guess what type of warfare they were famous for. Anybody know? They fought their battles on horse. And guess what? When they came, they didn't just bring the army with them. They brought mum, dad, and the kids. They brought the lot. The whole lot arrived on horseback. And they were the most formidable and ferocious warriors on horseback that possibly the world's ever seen. They were astonishing warriors on horseback. And isn't it interesting that when we come to this prophecy, see what it says, verse 4? And I will turn thee back and put hooks in thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen. That's interesting, isn't it? Horses and horsemen. See verse 15? And thou shalt come from thy place out of the north part, thou and many people with thee, all of them riding upon horses. All of them riding upon horses. That was the notable feature of the Scythian campaign method, to ride on horseback. And where do they come from? And we'll mention this tomorrow because I think it's a crucial part of the correct identification of the prophecy. Verse 15, they come from their place out of the north parts. Those north parts, to find real and proper fulfillment, I think lie beyond the Caucasus. And I think the evidence is the Scythian invasion, which formed the historical backdrop to, in fact, the words of this particular prophecy. Now, I'm just going to move on because I'm not going to use that slide tonight. I just want to come to this one here. I was going to take this out, actually, and then I thought I might just leave it in. It's not actually related to the Scythians, but it's connected to what we did this afternoon. It's just an illustration of what we did this afternoon in a bit more detail. So what this really gives us is an imperative of two things. A latter-day invasion out of the north parts coming into the Middle East, modelled on the Scythian invasion of BC 630. And when that Scythian invasion came down, not only did they invade Palestine, but what other territory did they bring under control? They brought the area of Iran under control. Who's the first ally mentioned in Ezekiel 38 of Gog? Persia, verse 5. The power of Iran. So when Gog comes down, Iran is allied, says Ezekiel 38. Now here's another completely different line of evidence. It's got nothing to do with Scythians, but it's just interesting, is that who do you think the latter-day king of the north is from Daniel chapter 11? King of the north comes down. There's a connection here, isn't there? Because Gog comes out of the north parts. This king is the king of the north. Who do you think the latter-day king of the north is? Well, logically, the latter-day king of the north is probably the king who controls the territory that used to belong to the king of the north. And the king of the north is a phrase out of Daniel 11 which relates to the Seleucid power, doesn't it? You want to see what the Seleucid power looked like in ancient times? Here's the Seleucid power. So where did the Seleucids, what territory did the Seleucids cover? And the answer is, the territory of the ancient Seleucid Empire includes part of Turkey and essentially all of Syria, Iraq, and surprise, surprise, Iran. The power controlling this entire region becomes the king of the north at the time of the end. So what we've now got is two separate prophecies that indicate that if the king of the north is Russia and it controls Iran, and Gog is coming from the uttermost parts of the earth and has Persia in collaboration with it, then we've got two independent Bible prophecies that say that when Russia comes down, Iran will be one of its associates. Daniel 11 and Ezekiel 38 both imply the same thing, don't they? A Russian drive, but with Iran as one of their main accomplices. Of course, in order to make any point about that, what would we need to do? We'd need to show that Daniel 11 and Ezekiel 38 are connected, which is what we did this afternoon. So here's the same thing, but in a little more detail. Their time for invasion, their place of origin are the same in Ezekiel 38, 39 and Daniel 11, 12. Their vassal allies and battle sequence are the same. Their devastating speed and overwhelming attack are the same. Their intention to plunder and spoil en route are the same. And their exact position and dramatic end are the same. And therefore we postulate with reasonable biblical evidence this time that the Gog, who's the prince of Ross of Ezekiel 38, has got to be the king of the north of Daniel chapter 11. And what we've done is brought two Armageddon prophecies side by side and matched them up and said all the details match. So we can accept these as parallel prophecies. They both prophesy a power out of the north that comes and advances with Iran as one of their accomplices. Interesting, isn't it? So, just leading on from that, what's our anticipation? And the answer is, well, in fact, history is probably going to repeat itself in this case. We expect to see a build-up of things that will bring Russia and Iran together, if Ezekiel 38 be true, as well as Daniel chapter 11. Any rapport between Russia and Iran we would see as biblical evidence of that development of things leading towards Ezekiel 38 being fulfilled. And we wouldn't be surprised as Christadelphians, therefore, to see that state of affairs developing. And in fact, I think that's exactly what is happening. Here's just a couple of pieces of historical information from a signs of the times point of view. In 2007... the nations that surround the Caspian Sea decided to have a summit meeting. Guess who called the meeting? The answer is actually the Iranians down here. So here's the nations. These are the nations that surround the Caspian. Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan and Iran. Now, you probably can't think back as far as 2007, but what was going on at that stage is that America was rattling its sabres and suggesting that they wanted to put some degree of military facility in one of those territories. I can't remember whether it was Azerbaijan or Kazakhstan, but the Americans wanted to put a base there. Russia said, I think it's time we had a summit with the Caspian leaders. So Iran said, actually, we'd like to host it. Let's meet in Tehran, shall we? And so they set the summit up, which brought together these two powers in particular. And as a result of that, they signed some agreements. There was a joint agreement of all the littoral, that means the coastal states, that said that no one of these four or five places will allow their territory to be used for aggression against any other Caspian state. So they ruled America out of being able to put anything there against Russia. So that was one of the objectives of the meeting. They had a joint agreement to advance their regional cooperation to develop oil and gas resources of the Caspian together. And so those agreements were quite significant. But then there was one more agreement signed, but only two of those five nations signed it. You'd never guess which two nations signed the last agreement, would you? Surprise, surprise. A special joint agreement of strategic understanding between Russia and Iran, alias Rosh and Persia, for political, economic and cultural cooperation. But it wasn't just political, and it wasn't just economic, and it wasn't just cultural. Turned out, actually, it was going to be sort of military as well. And we know that because that's the Caspian summit in October 2007, but they decided to have a get-together in July 2009, and they said, let's have a joint military exercise, us Caspian Sea chaps. I think we need to have a bit of work together to make sure all of our systems are go and that they all communicate with one another. So they did. They had a joint military exercise. So how many states were there around the Caspian? Do you remember them again? There was Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, Iran, five Caspian nations who all signed those summit meeting agreements in 2007. Funny thing, you know, is they didn't all fire bombs and rockets in the exercises in 2009. In fact, strangely, it turned out that the joint military exercises of the Caspian, in fact, turned out to only involve two nations. You'd never guess which two nations decided to collaborate together, would you? Just the ones in red. Russia and Iran. So they had a joint military exercise called the Regional Collaboration for a Secure and Clean Caspian, held on the Caspian with 30 naval vessels. Why running around in your military vessels is something to do with a clean Caspian, I'm not sure, but it sounded like a jolly good title for a military exercise. And so they did. But they were all Iranian and Russian vessels. And so despite the title, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan were not involved. Only Russia and Iran participated. And the joint exercise, said one report, may prove the starting point for more comprehensive military activity between the Russian and Iranian navies. Funny thing, you know, when you start to see Bible prophecy, all this sort of stuff starts to make sense in the news, doesn't it? Closer cooperation at not only an economic and political level, cultural level, but also at a military level between Russia and Iran, because that's exactly what Ezekiel 38 says. When this latter-day invasion takes place, Iran's going to be one of the partners in that invasion. So we oughtn't to be surprised to see that state of affairs developing right now. Well, leading on from that, what do we expect then? Well, I think what we expect is this. What we expect is that Ezekiel 38 is really a prophecy of the Scythian invasion of the latter days. So that's another title for you for Ezekiel 38. The Scythian invasion of the latter days, because that's what that was its historical background. And the mysterious Gog of the land of Magog has got Scythian origins. And it was his grandson that led that previous campaign. And the interesting thing is that when you actually have a look at Ezekiel 38. Do you know what Ezekiel 38 says is going to happen? Well, not just Ezekiel 38, but Daniel chapter 11 says there's going to be a sudden dramatic appearance out of the north and a lightning thrust down through the coastal plain. Where have you seen that before? Straight down through the middle of Palestine from over the top of the Caucasian mountains. Ezekiel 38 says that, so does Daniel 11. It also says that there will be a swift advance into the land of Egypt for plunder. Then having got to the land of Egypt, what are they going to do? They're going to turn around again, and they're going to come back, and there'll be a return through Palestine for spoil and conquest, just like it was in the days of the Scythian invasion of old. And who's going to lead it? Russia and Iran. It's the Scythian invasion of the latter days. So the suggestion behind this study, therefore, is that there was a specific historical context to the prophecy of Ezekiel 38. It so turned out that Ezekiel's prophecy was never fulfilled and yet awaits fulfillment, but when it does, there are clear Scythian overtones to the story, aren't there? Because it's already happened in the past. And because God already knows it's happened in the past, he already knows what's going to happen in the future. And this time, the outcome of the invasion is going to be quite different, because that power is going to be... They'll never get back over the Caucasian mountains this time. They're going to fall on another set of mountains altogether, and they'll never go home again. Your hand, sir.
It seems like this invasion that happened before is critical in understanding what's going to happen. Why do you think it's absent from the Bible?
I've got no idea. The trouble is that because it's absent, I can only postulate, and because postulation is just that, it's probably worthless. Really, it's my opinion. Might be intriguing, might be even interesting, might be even courageous, but it's probably useless. So I honestly don't know. It is strange that such a thing is not reported, but there's no biblical record of it. Yes. Yes, it does. Yep. Because even if you'd never heard of that Scythian background before, we all have a fair view of what Ezekiel 38 is all about and how it's going to outwork. This just adds another layer of, as you say, interest to it, Tim. But it's not essential to our proper interpretation of the prophecy. But I do think it's a really valuable background. And why is it a valuable background? Because when you have all this debate about where the invading power comes from, I think the proof of the context is it's got to come from over the top of the Caucasian Mountains, because that's where it came from last time. That's where Gog came from last time. That's where he was. Whatever those powers were in Ezekiel's time, they'd already moved up and over northwards of that area by the time of Ezekiel's prophecy. I think that forms the backdrop for our expectations for the future. Ben?
Where does Ethiopia, Libya, Gomer, and Sodom?
That is tomorrow's study. So we finished a little bit early, but I think that's great. So we'll have a break now for 10 minutes. And then we'll reconvene for another session on the framework of Bible prophecy.